From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Chad Beter.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
And welcome to Defrag Tools. And what is on tap for today? What are we going to talk about today, Andrew?
Part 3 of Windows Performance Toolkit. We're going to jump down to the command line. As I said a couple of episodes ago, I think the best way of learning about event tracing for Windows, Windows Performance Toolkit, is to see it the raw way, see the fundamentals, where things come from, and the way you will teach you that is through the command line. It's going to be very texty and that type of thing, but hopefully we'll have some fun with it.
Go grab a cup of coffee.
Yeah, I got mine.
So we showed you the UI in the Windows Performance Recorder. Just type WPR and in search, and then you'll find it if you have Windows Performance Toolkit installed. And there's a whole lot of these profiles, and as we talked about last week, some of these get quite heavy. There's a lot of data in them.
And so what do you mean by quite heavy?
Well, this one wants to record, I think if we record nothing and just use the default profile, it's going to use 5% of my RAM, so 487 meg.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's a fair bit.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of providers in here, and so quite frankly, you don't need some of them. And
yeah.
And when you're trying to do particularly a more delicate performance analysis where you don't want to put stress on the system, that's probably a little bit too much.
Yeah.
So both from a CPU point of view and from a memory point of view. So what I'm going to show you first is how you can roughly check these checkboxes at the same from the command line. So let's open up a min command prompt. Windows Performance Toolkit, most of these things are all administrator level things. It's all down the kernel, raw data, so you need to be elevated. So the WPR command line is not that actually that hard. It's relatively simple to use, and that's actually one of its downfalls because it still isn't as granular as we want. So we're going to have to fall back to the XPerf command line as well to go a bit further. So how do you look at the equivalent of what's on the GUI thing? Minus profiles, if I bring up the other one side by side, you'll see that there's a one-to-one relationship. So there's the general profile that we've talked about that's always turned on, and then there's CPU, disk file, and so on, which all match up to these. And even when you go down to the scenario-based ones, audio, video, for example, they're down there as well. And there's your favorite, the GPU one for your CUDA offloading in your rendering, right? So what we can do is drill into one of those. And so let's see how hot the general profile one is, right? And so if you, the command is minus profile details, plural. And what this does is it shows you what's turned on, how much memory is going to get used, all that type of stuff. And as you can see, there's all of these, there's a fair few keywords turned on, and I'll go into those ones in more detail when I go to XPerf, but just remember that there's a lot.
Is there any way to see this these details through the GUI, or do you have to use the command line for this?
I don't think you can see it through the GUI, no. It's kind of hidden away from you. It's the positive and the negative of the GUI, I guess, is that it's easy to use, but a little bit too easy. As you can see, we're using 1 meg buffers, and in this case it's 406, so 406 megabytes to record this stuff. These guys are the graphs we saw in Windows Performance Analyzer, and then this is data attached to it, which is stacks, and I'll get to that once again in the XPerf command line. But just to have a look that, realize that a lot of things have been turned on, and for all those data graphs, we're also appending a lot of stack information. The other thing that WPR does it turns on a lot of other providers. So those top ones are the NT kernel provider. That's what I'm going to focus on today, because actually that's usually all you need. But it's these bottom ones that give you a little bit more than that. So this is turned on providers to do with malware and JavaScript and power management and RPCs and all these other things. So a lot of data. And these numbers on the end is like a bit flag saying, I want to turn on these bits. So bit 5 might represent extreme warnings, and bit 6 might be horrific warnings and whatever. So it's just a mask.
FF would mean basically everything.
Yeah, every bit, yeah. And some of these masks are huge, right? So when there's more bits involved, the masks get bigger and bigger and bigger. there's also, you'll notice there's capture state providers on save. And when we did the repro the other day, when we press save, it took ages. And what it's doing is this post-rundown, and it's actually invoking all of these providers to get additional information. And the reason why we do that particularly is this top one, or these top ones to do with .NET. That's how we get all the PDBs and stuff for .NET programs. So, as I said, it's relatively easy. You can just go, you know, my start, let's say, you know, we start the CPU one. And that's now running, right? You know, you can bring up Task Manager and you'll see that relatively not really much has changed. Performance-wise, not really doing that much in the background. But, you know, it is there. So when you start doing things, it's going to start logging things. So it's kind of like a snowball effect. You know, you do more activity and it causes more activity and that might cause issues. Obviously, you know, and you stop. And as it takes a while, as I said, it's got all these providers. The CPU provider was slightly different. And then we get the CPU provider. It didn't actually give me a good name. ETL is the file name for trace files, event tracing for Windows log file. And then up it comes, and we can analyze it to the nth degree. So that's not what we're going to do today. We're just going to stay in the command line. So you don't really have control over, as I said, showed you before, the with the buffering. I didn't get to specify any of these numbers, right? I didn't get to, decide, okay, I want this to be tiny, stuff like that. Also, I didn't really have any control over these predefined things either. So,
and that's kind of a double-edged sword because you may not know what values to use for the number of buffers and things, and so if you're not sure, it is kind of nice to have it just give you some defaults. But if you do need that extra control, then you need to use another tool.
I think there's been an education issue with Windows Performance Toolkit because the command line I'll show you next, which is horrifically long, is all there was up until Windows 8. So Windows Performance Recorder was added in Windows 8. It uses .NET 4.5, I think, or 4.0. And because of that, it's only supported on Windows 7 and Windows 8. But you know, these tools have been around for years. XPerf, which is like a console program, no .NET involved, is supported all the way back down to Windows 2003. The installer won't let you install it on 2003, which also includes XP, because there's no .NET. So the visualizer is .NET, but the recorder is just pure, you know, Win32 pure code. And so what you can do is you can install it, you know, on Windows 7, Vista, whatever, and then just copy the files to Windows 2003, just run the gathering tools, grab the file, and bring it back. And that's actually what I suggest on servers and what we did on the show is we ran it once, harvested off the files, and then put it in the My folder, which is what's... So My came from Windows 8, and then we harvested it off. And that's just grab these files. I don't know what the supportability is like on using the Windows 8 like on downstream, but I definitely know the Windows 7 one works all the way down to 2003. There is caveats, and I'll tell you them when I get to it. So there's not really much more you can do with Windows Performance Recorder on the command line, apart from the one that Chad talked about the other day, which is this bottom one. if you run the UI, you'll get this dialog saying, do you want to set this? Once again, like Chad said the other day, you can do it on the command line as well. So if you're scripting it, you should do that first and then go minus start something. Use some tool to sleep for, say, 10 minutes or something, and then 10 minutes later do your stop, and then off you go. So as I said, we want a more granular way of looking at this. And this is where XPerf comes from. That's where...
This is the old way of
doing it. And XPerf's help is both fantastic and horrific.
Does this have a one-to-one relationship with WPR?
The help... Oh, the commands, definitely not, no. Well, yeah. Kind of. They've got the same style, but not really.
Yeah.
Because of the extra granularity, that's what the difference is. So the start and stop are kind of the same, kind of. But then there's all these other, you know, 5 or 10 more that you have to type.
And a lot of the profiles and things are different compared to WPR as well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So if I mean, the problem with this is, and I'll show you something, I'll type symbols. You know, it just scrolls and scrolls help. So if you're just trying to find that quick answer, that nice little command line, you're not going to find it. So it's one of the things where you need a bit of experience to find it, or just get someone else to teach you, which is what we're going to do. So what we did with WPR is we showed the profiles. XPerf has the same concept, and so the profiles in WPR encompass the NT kernel logger, which is the NT kernel provider, and also these other ones. XPerf doesn't have those other ones baked in. It just is entry-centric. The keyword, it's weird as, I know, but minus providers, and then a K for kernel, and then G is show groupings, which is like the word for profiles. And so this is the profiles you've got. And to answer your question, are they equivalent? Kind of, but not really. For starters, they're much smaller, all right, because they haven't got all this extra information. But they kind of got the same idea. Like base is roughly about the same as the general profile. Actually, I'll bring up a second command window and put them side by side. I got a lot of snap. Diag's kind of analogous to CPU a bit, but then it gets kind of off the rails. There's no file.io is kind of like disk and file added together, and then it, you know, really does get off the rails, and then not really equivalent. So what are all the, I mean, why do we have these profiles, and what do these words mean? And we saw them spew out in the WPR one for a profile, that top list. Well, that's roughly what these capital letter ones are. And so these are the groups or profiles that XPerf has, and they just refer to these individual pieces of data. And the way you can find that data is use KF, which is kernel, and I have no idea what F stands for, but it's F. I don't know.
Flags filters,
something. Sure. Yeah. And so there's a fair few, and what I do every time a new XPerf comes out, I do a KF, roughly that's its intrinsic ability, and then I do a diff between with that Windows 7 and Windows 8, for example, and to see, you know, what have they added, what's the new good stuff. Really important, because you don't want to turn a flag on that doesn't exist on a prior OS. So even though you're using a higher version of the Xe on a low S, don't turn a flag on that doesn't exist, because that's dangerous.
Makes sense.
And most of them haven't changed. I mean, I reckon probably the first half of all, you know, probably all of these have been around since 2003, actually since 2000, I think. So what is, how do you choose, you know, which ones of these you're going to do? Well, read the description, right? I mean, I'm interested in DPCs. Okay, that's the DPC one. It's called DPC. Right, and most of the names are really obvious too. I mean, duh. Mm-hmm. So you'll notice that there's a prefix here that is constant, and the reason why we have that is we want the data to be usable. I mean, what it's recording is just pure numbers, right? It has no real, maybe word context associated with it, and so these two ones on the front provide that context. If you don't have those, you're just going to be in a sea of hexadecimal. Right, and what the first one does, the proc thread, the proc part means record process IDs, thread says record thread IDs, and then the loader one is record the module that something came from. So a module has needs to know a process scope it's in to be make the address resolvable, and so if with those three you can say, hey, I was an explorer in this thread and I'm in the module explorer.exe or shell32.dll or something. So without a doubt, always put those on the front.
Without those, you'd just basically see that something happened, but you'd have no idea who did it, right?
Yeah.
Which is not very useful.
Yeah, you just get this hexadecimal. You'll get the address of the thread.
Yeah, which is
pointless, absolutely pointless. And then we go into specifics. So We're going to go into the specifics in other episodes, you know, why I want to turn this flag on, that flag on. But generally, if you're playing and just want to do things simply, use WPR, choose the general profile and some of the other ones. If you want to be a bit more hardcore, come back here and just choose some of these from the list. You'll see that the amount of data significantly reduces, which is good because the less data you're collecting, the longer the trace for the same amount of memory, right?
So would you recommend being a little bit this more granular approach on, like maybe on a server, for example, that's a production
environment?
Definitely.
I always, whenever I give something to someone else to do, I always give them the most granular thing I can do. I bring it down to the absolute bare minimum. When I'm doing it for myself, where I'm in control of the laptop and it's not really a live scenario or there's not an education issue, I'll turn on checkboxes with WPR. So personally, I use WPR, particularly if it's if I'm trying to profile a Windows Store app, right? Because of all the .NET support and the JavaScript support that comes with it automatically. XPerf does that. There's a flag for it, and I'll have to look it up and put it in the show notes. But you can, in the Windows 8 version, cause the same effect of that, you know, the PDB generation. But it's way easier through the UI. But as I said, when I give someone something to do, I always give them the script. That way I know it's going to start the right way, trace the right duration, and end the right way. And there's actually endings important as well.
And you can minimize the amount of extra stuff that's in the trace that you don't care about.
And yeah, it's also an upload issue, right? I mean, it's either you get to the length of your trace and then it's got a longer duration because the data fits, or it's a long trace and, you know, I don't want to have a 12 gigabyte log file to review. So let's have a look at what the extra command lines are in XPerf and how it kind of applies. Now, normally WPR had minus start as well. It's kind of weird. I mean, you start every provider except the kernel provider in XPerf. For the kernel provider, you say the word minus on. I don't know why they did it that way. It's just the way it is. So
it made sense to the programmer who programmed it.
Yeah. So, for example, if I just do base, base is one of those groups, and So this is an example of what you get. If another provider is already running, you cannot start a new provider. So it's a singular system. Now, I think, yeah. So that's now tracing in the background. So XPerf stop. These are all generic programs who are talking to ETW. XPerf, WPR, Process Explorer, Process Monitor, you know, a slew of programs, Logman. These guys are just telling ETW to turn things on and off. So I didn't start that provider, but I can use the minus stop command to stop all providers. Right.
That's a good point, is that these aren't necessarily the only programs that can turn on and off ETW providers. Anybody can do this through APIs. So these are just sort of front ends to a mechanism that's built into the operating system.
Yeah. So that's running now, and then if I go minus XPerf, minus stop, and this is going to stop it, and what I want to tell it to do is there's a file that it's backing this by, and it's right here in the root of C drive, kernel.etl. And I haven't told it any size or anything, so currently it's 576K in it. It could have been bigger, it could have been smaller. The defaults are kind of up to it. What I'm going to do is that kernel file hasn't done all that proc, you know, that proc thread loader thing I was talking about. It hasn't merged that data in yet, so it has to like gather additional metadata and put it into the ETL file so that these numbers can refer to this data to look it all up. And that's what minus D does, which is merge. I don't know why it's, and then I tend to call mine result.etl because I know that it's the file name. And what it's doing is it's getting the kernel, it's stopping the provider. It's grabbing the kernel.etl file, which backed a lot of this data. It's flushing out the rest of the memory to that file. And then, as I said, it's getting all this additional metadata and merging into the file. If you miss this step, you cannot do simple resolution in XPerf. It's not the end of the world, though. So a good example is we run XPerfs trying to work out what led up to a bug check, right, blue screen. We know that the blue screen's hit hard, bang, and that's bad, right? But it means this merge is missing. You still can look at the file but you'll have to look through it with all the hexadecimal numbers, which is actually okay because you have a dump file. So in the dump file, you go, you ask the dump, you know, you say X and then the address, and it will tell you the symbol. So, okay, sure, it's annoying that it's numbers in the GUI, but you can actually open a dump file and find out what it is.
Do the hard work yourself to kind of merge it.
Yeah, and the, was it on Defrag Show? Yeah, on Defrag Show, I talked about the DPC watchdog timeout. That's a classic example, right? You want to know what all the DPCs were running up to, all the slow DPCs running up to it, and then finally it will crash and it will say, hey, this DPC took too long. Well, that guy may have been really, really short, and the guy before him may have been really, really long. And so you can use the trace to see what the history was up to that point. You'll just have pure numbers, but you can then look in the dump file to find out what the function was, the DPC function that took too long. Anyway, so this is made a file, much like before. It made a file, and you'll see this time, I'll use XPerf View to show it, because it's got a little bit better UI just for what I want to show you.
I'm missing a F.
There's not many providers. I mean, Base turned on a fair bit, but it's not a huge amount. So one of the ones was profile, which is these three. So these three are a visualization of this one single profile keyword. Storage, disk, disk visualization, disk, they're all from the disk I/O keyword. Memories from the memory one, and process, here's the proc thread, proc thread one at the front. That's the loader one. Hard faults was one of the keywords, and then generic events. I'm not sure what turned that one on. And then there was a memory keyword. That's actually about a quarter of what the other one was, right? So how do you control size, right? I mean, we're still in the same kind of limitations of where WPR with the command line is. We can turn the things on and turn them off, but we don't have any control. Well, XPerf does have control. So when we turn things on, let's say we turn on base, what you can do is control the buffer size. So, the buffer, I mean, the data has to go somewhere in memory, right? And so we make these blocks of memory. I tend to use 1024, and this is in kilobytes. It's kind of like a balance, isn't it? I mean memory fragmentation is one of those things. I mean,
Well, these are all allocated out of non-page pool, right?
Yeah.
So if you make these buffers too large, that can cause problems with memory allocation, other things that want to allocate memory out of non-page pool.
Yeah.
Because you'll get this fragmentation. You may not be able to find a large enough free block for somebody else to allocate.
Because allocations are contiguous, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to be a contiguous space to allocate. So if you can't, say, have all these, you know, 200K blocks and go give me a megabyte, it won't pull them out from separate entities. It has to be a linear space.
Yeah, if somebody does a non-page pool allocation, we have to find a contiguous free non-page pool block that is of that size, right?
Yeah.
So if there's not one, then that'll fail. Even if you have plenty of free non-page pool, if you ask for a big one, it's got to be contiguous.
Yeah.
And so that's where you would not want to make this too large, because then you increase the chances of that happening.
But there's a balance, right? Because you want the data to go into it, but if you say you made it 1K, well, for example, say you made it 50K, the providers come in as streams, right? And so they get like put into these buffers. So like, you know, the proc part of proc thread goes into the one buffer, and the thread part goes into another buffer, and the loader goes into another buffer. And so within each buffer, you don't want it to roll too much, because that does affect your longevity. So if someone's running really hot, a small buffer will roll really quickly, and then you cause a lot of ejection of the buffers, and you cause a lot of writing out to disk and various other things.
So what's the right size?
I use 1024, and an email.
How much does that actually give you, just approximately?
Well, it's 1 meg, 1024 kilobytes.
But I mean, how much information are you going to get on that?
Most of my tracing, so I usually make 256 megabytes, which I'll show in a sec. I usually get on a hot system, like I'm talking about a hot system, about somewhere between 10 and 45 seconds per provider.
Yeah.
Normally 30 seconds plus. But I'm talking about a really, really hot system, which I am asking for a huge amount of data. If you step back a bit and just do a bit more statistical, like say I did power management, and all I'm watching is the frequency of the chip mm-hmm. and how idle the CPUs are, it could last half an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours.
Yeah.
So it is about the data coming in. The rolling of the buffers is what really hurts you. It's more of a hit to the disk. Mm-hmm. If you make the buffers smaller and you say, I want to keep this data, and every time it rolls,
yeah.
You're causing disk churn. And disk, I mean, I don't know what the optimal data size is when you're talking to the disk, but I'm sure asking it to put lots of small writes is not good. Mm-hmm. Bigger writes are faster, right?
Yeah, and there's some logic in a lot of disk controllers and things to try to combine writes. But it's in general, when you're doing disk writes, it's better to do fewer bigger writes than a lot of small writes, just mm-hmm. because it's so much more overhead to the disk subsystem. So yeah, so that's the trade-off, right? If you make these buffers too small, now you're doing a lot of smaller writes to the disk, yeah. and that can hurt you too.
As I said, and the internal email help aliases that we have about this tool, I don't see anybody say anything about 1024. That's what everybody defaults to. So I think yeah. the ultimate yes. wisdom of all the Microsoft geeks is 1024. So how many of these buffers do you want? We saw that in the other thing, there was like 409 of these 1 meg buffers. You notice that even WPR use 1 meg buffers. So there's min buffers and max buffers. So obviously it defines how many I should start with and how many you can grow to if it's necessary. I personally always make them the same value because I want XPerf to get in there, do all this hard memory allocation work, and then get out of the way and not interrupt my actual observation, right? So if I know that the system can take 256 megabytes of buffer, which is what most systems can, even big servers, you don't want to be overzealous because things like Exchange and SQL and SharePoint, they use nearly all the RAM up to within megabytes of what there is.
Yeah.
You don't want to be squeezing those guys out. So even though they've got maybe 64 gig of RAM and you could easily say I can fit 2 gig, you don't want to be doing that because those systems just aren't designed to be pushed around like that. By having the same minimum max, you're allocating at the start and then running consistent. And then the last one is max file. Is how, so that's in memory at the moment. How big do you want the file that's going to be where it's going to stream to eventually to get? If you make it the same size, it means that the buffers are going to, in circular mode, which I'll get to in a sec too, the buffers are going to circle at 256 meg, and there's going to be no point where there's pressure to, say, put it out to disk.
Yeah.
Right? Which means you keep your disk utilization down low. And so when you stop it, that's when it actually merges out. To make it go around in a circle like that, you need to put the circular keyword, your keyword on it. And so as I said, this is going round and round and round, and then it will eject.
And the key time that you'd want to use circular is when you maybe have an intermittent problem, you don't know when it's going to happen, right?
Yeah. I'm also more of a fan of it just from a safety point of view. I don't like the idea of something running and getting bigger and bigger. So if I don't put max file on it, it will put it out to disk, and it will be 260 megabytes of memory buffer, and then it will put it out to that kernel.atf file, and it will grow as big as it has to grow. And I don't like that. I like the idea that it sticks to the circular size. And to make all those things stick and get correct, as I said, you need to make them all the same. There is one scenario where you know that you want a bit more longevity, but you just can't afford the RAM, and so you can make the file bigger than the RAM. And what happens is the RAM will flush out to the file as it works, and the file will be bigger, and then the circular will run on like the 1 gig size. But I never run it without circular. It's just from a safety point of view.
Well, and it keeps you from getting these ridiculously large log files.
There is one scenario where, which I don't personally do, but because I tend to be watching it and press stop, is I know that I want a trace, and I want a 1 meg trace, and I don't care if that takes 1 minute, and I don't care if it takes 1 day, but I want a 1 gig trace, right? And so if you drop off the circular, because there's the max file on it, it will write to the file, and then when it gets to a gigabyte, it goes, okay, you said that's the final, and then it will stop. So it's kind of good for when you have no idea what the data rate's going to be. I usually don't put myself in a situation where I don't know what the data rate is. I test it first, work it out, and then give it to the person. So much like before, you turn it on, and now this is running non-page pool buffers of 1 megabyte, and 256 of them, putting into a file on disk that's, in this case, a gigabyte.
And you'd be able to see these, like using a tool like RoundMap, you'd see those allocations, right?
So if we look in, where's under, where pull tag is ETW buffer. ETW buffer. And there you go. And there's all the allocations in physical memory of those. This is pages, you know, different story, but RAM maps are about pages, so you need to divide it in by 4K and stuff. So there would have been 1,024 divided by 4 times 256 pages there. As I said, much less before, if you want to stop it, it's just minus stop. And don't forget to merge it out to.
Always use the dash D.
Always. There is scenarios where, and this happens in boot tracing, where you end up with a kernel ETL file and a user ETL file. And when you do that merge, you actually have to put all of the file names together. And it's kind of like the copy syntax in the command prompt, where you go like file name, destination. And then so you go...
File name plus file name.
Yeah. And so you stop it like this, and then...
Don't know about that.
And then you go... merge, and then you go like, you know, file1.etl, file2.etl. And it's kind of like, it's like the copy syntax, and it will copy the first two into one file, and then you can merge them together. Kind of useful if you actually started two providers, which we're not going to get into that detail, but you actually can start two at once and then merge the two together.
And it'll put them in chronological order.
Right? Yeah, yeah. I do use it. We showed how in the kernel debugging episode on ETW, how we can pull out the buffers and put them to disk. So if you have that bug check scenario where that file never got finished, what you do is you get that file that's never finished, you save the last part of it, the unread buffers or flush buffers, to disk, and then you merge them together. And so you'll get that last 30 seconds that's missing, right? It gives you lots of warnings saying, hey, this is not, wasn't stopped properly, blah, 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 but you just go, fine, whatever.
You're talking about pulling the ETL trace out of a memory dump?
Yeah. So you get the unfinished disk one plus the dump one, put them together, and then that will give you the last end milliseconds or seconds or whatever that wasn't there. As I said, you get lots of warnings, but when you open the viewer, you say, fine, whatever.
Pretty, yeah.
So that's really it for command line. What I've got, I do have what I'm going to do is I'm going to share on SkyDrive for all you guys. I have a whole lot of scripts of all my favorite combinations, right? So for example, I know the power one. I missed stack walking. I've got to do that in a sec. This is all my favorite ones. For example, these are the four I turn on when I'm looking at power, right? And then when I'm looking at general performance on the box, I use, all my scripts have this on the front just for the sake of it. And then I use four of the groups together, right? So a lot of those groups have the same keywords in them. It doesn't matter if you put the keyword over and over again. So like I've got proc, thread, and loader there. They're already in the groups. It doesn't matter. I've just concatenated all those together and said, record all those things. All right, the next part is stack walk. So one of the things that you can do is augment the data with stacks. So by default, when you run down a dump with all this pure data, you actually won't have the stack of who logged that event, right? And so that you've got the kernel groups, which I showed you before. Well, sorry, I should say the kernel, the KF things, whatever they call them. These are all of the data things you can get. At the same time, the keyword is minus help stack walk. There's no like minus providers stack walk or anything. And this will show you all of the events that, so all the stacks that you can get also in the trace. You don't have to, like if I'm grabbing, say, the file IO area of the kernel, I don't have to pick up every single stack associated with files, right? I can just be selective. And so...
So essentially what this is saying is that whenever one of these events happens, you want to get a call stack at that time.
Yeah. Then you could get the stack without the associated KF keyword, but it won't. The data won't be on a graph to view. Right, it won't be associated with, hey, this is the file name at this point in time, right? So it's kind of obvious to make sure that you pick up the stack and the underlining graph thing that is going to be on at the same time. In in Windows Performance Analyzer, the new GUI, you actually, one of the graphs is stacks. It doesn't require you to actually, you know, add the stack as a column to one of these data sets. You can just look at stacks. And so if you do make that mistake, and that still is semi-useful, for things like how hot was this, you know, like CPU, it does make sense. But for some other things, it just doesn't make sense. So how do we do this in the command line? It's kind of the same. So minus on was all these, you know, was these plusy keywords. Stack walk is the same. You just choose the ones you like. I'm just going to choose random ones, which are not really associated. I'm seeing, reg, open key. I'm just choosing random ones out of the list. And I might choose, I might also turn on base, right? And so what's going to happen now is I also will get stacks. Stacks are heavy, right? It's a lot of data to record a stack. You're recording 4K probably at least for every single stack call you're recording. It does get hot. The main one that we ask you to do, and this is the one that if you remember anything off the top of your head, this is the one. Base has these other keywords in it. So if you can remember anything, minus on base, minus stack walk profile. Even if you don't fool around with the file stuff on the end, the sizing stuff, just remember those two keywords, and then you're good to go. So in review, WPR UI, very easy to use, very low control. WPR command line, you can automate that to roughly the same level as the user interface. Use the profile details keyword to pull out what information is in something. And it was a general profile. And all these keywords here and all these stacks here, you can actually drill into them more with minus providers KF. For the first ones, and minus help stack walk for the rest. And that is it for the command line. A bit of a rush through it. As I said, I'm going to share out all my scripts, which I use day to day.
Excellent.
And feel free to ask questions and stuff like that. Next week, we will dive into CPU analysis.
Awesome. That's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can email us at defragtools@microsoft.com. See you next week.
Have a good week.